Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. We still have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And Ian, for the good martini, we turn to the pages of the New York Post. And this story, the Clinton Foundation's finances are so messy that the nation's most influential charity watchdog has put it on its watch list of problematic nonprofits last month. The Clinton family's mega charity took in more than $140 million in grants and pledges in 2013, but spent just $9 million on direct aid. The group spent the bulk of its windfall on administration, travel, and salaries and bonuses, with the fattest payouts going to family friends. They claim that, there's 2,000 employees, including workers in the field, so that's not part of the $9 million necessarily, but however you cut it, it's way below the 75% rate of spending that nonprofit experts say a good charity should spend on its mission. The watchdog here is Charity Navigator, which rates nonprofits, recently refused to rate the Clinton Foundation because its atypical business model doesn't meet our criteria, yet it still put the foundation on its watch list, which warns potential donors about investing in problematic charities. Also on the list of 23 charities is Al Sharpton's National Action Network. That's always good company to have when you're talking about ethical and good reputations. So, Ian, this is obviously good news in terms of trying to once again point out that the Clinton Foundation is a giant slush fund, which is another term that was used in the analysis here. But obviously there's bad news here in that people's money is being used to basically benefit the friends of the Clintons.
It's always ground rule one when donating to charity that you should be looking to see how much they're actually spending on charitable work. And so it seems like as far as those who donated money thinking that it was going to good causes, they've certainly been duped. But the flip side of that is it's hard to reasonably expect anything else given the Clintons' track record. The interesting thing here, for me at least, is that the story continues. Over the past month or so, the financial shenanigans of the Clinton Foundation have been front page news almost constantly, and that's quite extraordinary. We had the revelation that former Secretary of State allowed a Russian company to control one-fifth of the United States uranium production through a friend who was on the Clinton Foundation board. Last year, they revealed that they had failed to disclose a huge chunk of foreign donations for the better part of 3 years. They've refiled taxes. They say there are missteps. That's perfectly euphemistic coming from the Clintons. It's so much more than missteps. What you have is just an enormous financial apparatus that has been set up to cater to the Clintons, their whims, all of the different enterprises of questionable legitimacy that they've wanted to support over the last several years. It's really an extraordinary thing that's happening, and it's good that the press continues to track this and try to run it to ground, because it seems hard to think of any comparable situation in recent years that shows just the deplorable nexus that exists for certain people of power and how they can use their connections to profit themselves at the expense of the country, their donors, etc. It's really an extraordinary thing that we're watching unfold.
Reports are that there are 11 quote-unquote amazing coincidences between State Department policy and donations to the Clinton Foundation in this book, Clinton Cash, by Peter Schweitzer. We've gotten a little bit of a taste of about three of them, from the uranium to the Haitian earthquake to things happening in Colombia. So it'll be very interesting to see what else is out there, whether the most salacious stuff is already known or whether we're just getting started here. All right, we will be back to Mrs. Clinton in the crazy martini, but on to the bad martini now and talk about your contrast in appearances. On Saturday night in Washington, the media was genuflecting to the president at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, despite the fact that the president has stiff-armed the press more than pretty much any president. And recent memory. Yet just less than an hour to the north, protests turned very violent in Baltimore. So violent, in fact, that near the Inner Harbor area, that fans at the Baltimore Orioles baseball game were forced to shelter in place until the more calm was restored in the area. The protesters were, of course, in the streets demanding justice for the death of Freddie Gray. He is the man who, I believe his funeral is actually today. He was in police custody, and ultimately his spine was severed due to his handling by the police. It's a worthy investigation. We don't know all the details yet at this point, but there certainly need to be answers for that type of conduct by the police. But at the same time, there is also responsibility for those protesting to conduct themselves responsibly, and that certainly did not happen. Lots of property destroyed. Good reporters saying it was not the bulk of the protesters, but a sizable number of protesters led by folks like Malik Shabazz, who came from out of town to incite folks. And here's the interesting quote. Here's Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. Listen more towards the end of this quote, but she was talking about how she worked with the police to devise the strategy for dealing with the protests on Saturday.
I worked with the police and instructed them to do everything that they could to make sure that the protesters were able to exercise their right to free speech. It's a very delicate balancing act, because while we try to make sure that they were protected from the cars and the other, you know, things that were going on, we also gave those who wished to destroy space to do that as well. And we worked very hard to keep that balance and to put ourselves in the best position to de-escalate. And that's what you saw this evening.
Okay, Ian, smart for the police to obviously give the protesters as much leash as possible. But why the need to strike the balance between peaceful protesting and space to destroy?
Right. This is just it's unbelievable. Now it's official government policy that if you want to go out and shatter storefront windows and, you know, destroy police cars and throw trash cans and all, we're going to create a nice safe space for you to do that. I mean, it's just unbelievable. This is the protest mentality run amok among authority figures, where they've basically sort of stopped drawing a line between peaceful protest and violent protest, and say it's all on sort of this gray spectrum, and now we have to countenance all of it. It's horrible policy, and it doesn't at all serve the purposes, not just of the city of Baltimore and law-abiding citizens, but even those who might be protesting legitimately. It's important to note, we frequently talk about rioting going on. In Baltimore, this was legitimate rioting. These were hundreds of people brawling openly in the streets. This was the real deal. The fact is that it really has very little to do with Freddie Gray, the man, other than as the occasion for people who want to riot to have an occasion to do so. And so all that Stephanie Rawlings Blake and the rest of the structure of authority is doing is effectively to say, now you can riot sort of consequence-free, and we're not even going to question it. We don't even care if this has any sort of relation to the problem at hand. You know, that does a huge disservice, like I said, not just to all citizens, but to legitimate complaints that may be out there, because it just legitimizes the violence itself. If that's the way that we're going to begin to handle race protests in the United States, we're in for a whole lot more trouble.
And hats off to the Gray family. They were at that press conference before that, a comment from the mayor, and they said without any equivocation whatsoever that violence doesn't solve anything in this situation. The protesters who got out of hand were wrong, and so kudos to them for making that clear at that press conference. All right, on to the crazy martini now. And this happened Friday after our Friday edition, the three martini lunch, but it was so unbelievable we had to include it here in the Monday edition. Hillary Clinton speaking Friday at the 2015 Women in the World Summit and talking about the need to make sure that women's reproductive options were given as much access as possible.
Far too many women are still denied critical access to reproductive health care and safe childbirth. All the laws we've passed don't count for much if they're not enforced. Rights have to exist in practice, not just on paper. Laws have to be backed up with resources and political will, and deep-seated cultural codes, religious beliefs, and structural biases have to be changed.
And she went on to say, not just in other places around the world, but in the United States. So, Ian, I'm pretty sure there aren't too many religious beliefs that are opposed to safe childbirth. So she's clearly saying that in the United States, it is wrong to believe through your faith that abortion is wrong or should be limited in some way.
This is a perfect bit of Clinton equivocation, because for people who are working with NGOs working overseas, there are legitimate concerns about maternal mortality, these sorts of things that we ought to address. And we've seen historically that religious beliefs and cultural mores can play into that. The sleight of hand here is to equate, say, widow burning in India during the British colonial period with religious objections to abortion in, you know, Georgia. That's just nonsense. We can all agree that religious beliefs, cultural mores, et cetera, need to change in the first instance, and think that that's a difference not of degree but of kind when it comes to the second. What Clinton is able to do here, essentially make a political argument targeted toward her hard left Democratic base, who are the real extremists when it comes to abortion, in the generally agreeable language of international outreach in situations that in fact might be dangerous for women. It's a horrible act, like I said, of moral equivocation. It's one that needs to be called out. And it highlights in a sort of perhaps unintentional way the fact that the left doesn't care about religion, broadly speaking. Religious beliefs are important in as much as they contribute to worthwhile social causes. So if your religion is supportive of very careful stewardship of the earth, and we can sort of manipulate that into making your religion work toward purposes related to climate change, that religion is good. If your religion opposes abortion, then obviously we have to stamp that out. That's the whole American ethos exactly backward. The founders were explicit in making the importance of religious freedom the first and foremost part, not only of the Bill of Rights, but of the First Amendment. It's the first two clauses of that first right that's allowed to the people. So the argument that Clinton is making is, in its premises, a direct reversal of exactly what the founders intended. That's extremely dangerous. And as conservatives react to this, there's not just the need to point out the abortion extremism here, but the fact that the premises of the argument are un-American in a very serious way.
Hard to end on such a sobering note, but it's a very important one. And thank you very much, as always, for being with us. And we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Jim Garrity will be back on Tuesday. Join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.